Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. What do you think about when you think about good health? Your heart, your blood pressure, your weight? What about your ears? There are all sorts of health issues associated with hearing, from ear infections to hearing loss to the causes and treatment of tinnitus and beyond. On today's show, we will welcome your questions about these and other issues associated with hearing health. Our guest is Dr. Michael Novak. He is an otolaryngologist. Did I get that right? Yes. He's giving me the thumbs up from Carl's Audiology and Hearing Services. Dr. Novak, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me here.
I'm glad to have you with us. And as we begin our conversation, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And you can also reach out to us on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Okay, so what is an otolaryngologist? And how many points can you get using that word in Scrabble?
I think it's about 100 points.
All right.
But I can't even spell it, so it's hard for me to know. It's actually the known probably commonly as ear, nose, and throat doctors. Otolaryngology, of course, being the Latin or Greek, just to make it sound good.
Yeah.
It's a head and neck surgery specialty that most of us are trained 6-7 years of residency after medical school. All we do is head and neck. My specialty is otology, which is ears only, and all I do is ears and hearing as a subspecialty of otolaryngology.
We tend not to think of ears as being interrelated with the nose and the throat, but they are. I mean, there are things that, you know, you do something with your throat, it affects your ears. You do something with your nose, it affects your ears, and vice versa.
Oh, very clearly. One of the key things that we'll probably touch upon in the program is the fact that off of the back of the nose is the eustachian tube, little channel that goes up underneath the eardrum and lets air under the eardrum. It's the source of a lot of ear infections and ear problems. So, yeah, very clearly related.
It is, I believe, also the source, and correct me if I'm wrong, of why it is if your ears pop on an airplane and you swallow or you chew gum or you yawn, that can help clear it up.
Excellent. Yeah, the eustachian tube is closed all the time until a muscle pulls it open. That muscle opens when you swallow and when you yawn. So absolutely, you like them to pop on the airplane.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the more common things that you see and that are issues associated with our ears. And let's start with one that I feel like I know more and more people dealing with, and that could just be a function of I'm getting older. So I know older people that are dealing with this, but it's tinnitus. What is tinnitus or tinnitus?
Actually, either term, tinnitus or tinnitus, are correct. And so you can use either. And that's basically a sound that you hear that doesn't have any objective basis. There's no reason for you to hear a sound. There's no source. It's generated by your ears or your brain or both.
What kinds of sounds?
Most people describe sounds as a high-pitched background whine, a hiss, cicadas, or a humming type of sound are very common descriptions.
And is this something that can be treated?
It's something that can be understood and counseled. Treatment is difficult. And the good news is that most people describe both ears or just up in the head someplace, a background whine or hiss, and it's totally harmless.
So it's something you get used to, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. And brains are made to ignore things that are constant. They're looking for new stimuli, and that's when it first comes on. It's very distressing, very obvious. And over months, it just fades into the background someplace. And so the great, great majority of people have no problem with it.
Are there degrees of severity?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The volume or the intensity of the tinnitus is quite variable person to person and even day to day, week to week. Tinnitus patients or individuals will tell you, some weeks I notice it, some I don't. It's more of a matter of whether you pay attention or not. But there's a subgroup of maybe 5% of people that it's very distressing, very, very difficult for them to live with.
Is there anything you can do to prevent it?
Prevention is usually preventing the hearing loss. The great, great majority of tinnitus is associated with hearing loss. So noise-induced, very common in our society. So anything you can do to avoid noise damage is beneficial. Treating ear infections, very beneficial. But most people do fine. For treatment, there are now some devices and therapies that help people cope. And we can put on a hearing aid-like device that will play a sound in the background, music, for instance, that's pleasant, and bury your tinnitus in it. So that over time your brain begins to associate the tinnitus sound with something much more pleasant, something positive, and allows you to go in control of the tinnitus instead of the tinnitus controlling you. And most therapies are aimed at coping and covering up in a way.
Let's set tinnitus aside, but I'm curious about sounds that some people perceive and others do not, and particularly like frequencies that you might, you know, under some circumstance, all of a sudden, you know, hear like a really high frequency that maybe others don't hear or something like that. Does that happen commonly to everybody, or?
You mean where something will come on for seconds or minutes?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very common inner ear manifestation of just a harmless thing. It usually lasts you seconds to minutes, typically one ear versus the other. And often your hearing gets muffled at the same time, kind of a full sensation. Very normal.
What is that? Is that something about like air just finding its way in and out of your ear? What's going on?
Now, generally, it's fluid is inside the inner ear. The inner ear defined as the cochlea, where the nerve endings are for hearing. And there are three different fluid chambers within there that are necessary for normal hearing. If the pressure gets a little bit too high in one of those chambers momentarily, you'll get this manifestation of extra sound. So now, very common, very normal, very harmless.
Why is it, setting aside issues associated with hearing loss and something more permanent, there's some people that just seem to have really good hearing and others that maybe not so much over the course of their lives?
That's pretty much genetically determined. Your hearing potential is often just genetics. The hearing, normal hearing, is a range, anywhere from even minus 5 decibels down to 20 decibels, which is a big difference in hearing, but it's all considered normal. It's like vision in any other sense. There's some more sensitive to others, and not only the sensitivity to sound at the cochlea, but your ability to deal with it at the brain level, because you got to remember the ears are hooked to the brain, so everything's processed up at the brain level for the most part anyway. And so some of it's your how much attention you pay to it, how sharply you can tune certain things. Professional musicians hear things a little differently than the rest of us. Their ability to separate frequencies and the fine tuning is better than most. So yeah, there are definite internal differences.
Well, and that also gets into music and how some people have no problem separating out certain instrumentation as they're listening to music, and others know it's all one kind of noise or one kind of sound.
Yeah, that's very true. And part of it's a training. You can be somewhat trained to get better at differentiating frequencies, but some of it's just innate. Some people just aren't, some people aren't. And we see this tremendous range where it becomes more important, not that music isn't, but in speech understanding. And that's probably one of the biggest issues that we run into all the time. Sound comes into the inner ear, along the auditory nerve, into the brainstem, up to the cortex where it's processed. And that processing allows you to pick the sound you want out of the background. And probably lots of your listeners and anybody over about 30 or 40 is experienced sitting at a dinner table restaurant and having trouble understanding the person across from them when there's a lot of noise. So picking the voice out, the sound out, and understanding it compared to everything around you, that's even more important.
Well, I also wonder how much of it, do we hear every word that is spoken to us, or do we only hear enough that we can identify the patterns of the individual words and the phrases? And so our brain processes enough information to fill in the gaps.
Yes. We probably only need about 30% of the incoming signal to really understand what's going on. Now, that varies with context. You know, we process visually. We can look at the other person's face. We know what's coming in a conversation. That's usually pretty predictable. So the more context, the more familiar the subject, the less you need to understand. Now, if somebody just switches to a different topic or starts into something that's mathematical and precise, well, then you need to hear a lot more of it. Now, and obviously, husbands understand much less and maybe listen to much less than according to my wife. But in general, that's very true, that we don't need every word. We don't hang on every word as a rule.
I guess what I'm asking is what percentage do we typically hear?
Oh, we typically hear it all. We just pick out the salient features, enough to understand and then move on. Because that's all you're trying to do, typically, is understand a conversation. And a normal hearing listener, if we test them, will understand 96% of things and pull it out even out of a difficult background. But we don't, as a matter of course, in a conversation. So you're right. We don't need it all, which is how people with hearing loss, like many, many people with a little bit of high-frequency hearing loss as they get older or from noise, can get by pretty well by missing some but still filling in the blanks pretty well.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Dr. Michael Novak from Carl's Audiology and Hearing Services. We're discussing your ears and good hearing health, and we welcome your questions and comments about how our ears work, what happens when they don't, and any issues you, a friend, or a loved one may be having with your hearing or their hearing. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or as always, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I suppose we should talk about what may be the most common ear malady that everyone deals with at one time or another in their lives, and that's an ear infection. What happens when you have an ear infection? How does it happen?
Yeah, that is probably the most common thing seen by primary care doctors, especially pediatricians, family practice people. Almost everybody has an ear infection by the time they're six, and the great majority of children are going to have more than one by the time they get out of childhood. So basically what happens is the eustachian tube is not functioning well. They don't get air underneath the eardrum. So like we talked about, when the eustachian tube doesn't open every time you swallow, you don't get air. And within a few minutes, air is absorbed. Some of the gas is absorbed out from under the eardrum, and you get a negative pressure versus the outside. If that negative pressure lasts long enough, that could be days or minutes, you can start pulling fluid in from around the surrounding tissue. So you get fluid underneath the eardrum, which then may or may not get infected. There's plenty of bacteria in the back of the nose that can get into the ear very easily. So at first you get fluid, and then secondly, it may get infected. So that's the very common mechanism. There's certain bacteria that can go straight to the ear. They don't need to have eustachian tube problems and will create it. Allergic problems occasionally will cause a fluid buildup underneath the eardrum also. But it's basically a matter of not having air, getting fluid, and then maybe getting bacteria. Very common.
And why is it that young children are susceptible to this more than adults?
The eustachian tube in an infant is probably about 25% of the diameter of an adult. So part of it's just diameter. Part of it's that we're much more susceptible to congestion. You know, they have a lot more colds and congestion in early childhood.
And as you're taking a drink there, let me just remind our listeners, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We are discussing hearing health with otolaryngologist Dr. Michael Novak from Carl's Audiology and Hearing Services. We welcome your questions and comments for Dr. Novak at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You were saying.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry about that. But basically, ear infections will get better on their own as a rule. The natural course is about 5 to 7 days along with the cold. The fluid may persist for another week or so. Normal eustachian tube will take over and the fluid will clear and you go back to normal. And that's the typical. It's the subgroup of children with frequent ear infections where every month they're back in with another ear infection or fluid that persists. And we use a rough rule of thumb of 3 months. If fluid persists underneath an eardrum for more than 3 months, that's probably something that's going to get referred to one of the otolaryngologists for further evaluation, possibly treatment. Because you need air, especially in children who want hearing normal for normal speech, language, and academic development. So it's a very important issue, a very big issue, but it's probably the most common thing we see.
What impact can ear infections have on us? I mean, you mentioned, of course, hearing itself, but what else?
From what we see, the persistent hearing loss will interfere with your ability to develop speech in maybe a third of kids. And it's not necessarily their vocabulary or their language, though that can be affected later on, but the clarity of speech. You basically learn to produce what you hear. Mm-hmm. If you hear things muffled, if you hear things filtered, you're going to reproduce what you hear. So their speech clarity suffers. Left long enough, we will get later academic issues. Children get behind in the classroom. Their language can lag, which then affects literacy. So the academics of it are a big issue. We do see a group of children with the chronic fluid infections that will get permanent eardrum damage, chronic infections where they'll get damage to the ossicles, the bones underneath the eardrum, chronic infections that require surgical intervention to correct. Most of them can be corrected to a large extent, but not always. So, yeah, that's why even though you may or may not choose to actively treat, it's good to keep an eye on things and monitor to make sure that chronic problems aren't developing. They can.
Let's take a call. We have Scott on the line from Urbana. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. About 3 years ago or so, I got a diagnosis of hyperacusis by one of the clinicians there at the Carl Hearing Center. And she had me download this kind of noisemaker thing on my smartphone. But the other option for treatment was some kind of a sound-producing headphone system or whatever that wasn't covered by my insurance and cost about $1,500. And I wondered whether there had been any developments about treatment for that. I particularly have one specific problem, and it is the kind of real quick, almost like a barking sound that birds make that puts my ears into like physical pain. The other thing I wanted to know is I'm relatively sensitive to sounds generally, but I really don't want to sleep with earplugs in because I don't know, it just doesn't seem like that would be good for ear health. And so I guess those are the two questions that I have.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Now, hyperacusis is typically, as you were asking before, about somebody who's much more sensitive to average sounds than the rest. It's often a manifestation of some damage to the cochlea, where the dynamic range that we tolerate is much restricted. So you may function fine at an average level, and then something that most people find somewhat loud automatically becomes intolerably loud or painful. And is a good description that he gave. The treatment, you can't really fix it. You can't really correct it because it's an internal inner ear type of problem that's not approachable. So most of it is, as he mentioned, trying to adapt your surroundings. The simplest things, put in an earplug. Unfortunately, that muffles everything. There are earplugs available, and he may have been referring to them, that electronically will pick up a loud sound and shut down the earplug very quickly so that before things get too loud, you've got a dampener. But yet it stays unmuffled, unfiltered for average daily sounds. Used by people who need to understand speech and orders and around noise. Shooters occasionally use them. Musicians use them where there comes a point of tolerance, and you can set the earplug itself will sense it and automatically set the levels. As for earplugs at night, yeah, getting air into an ear is a good thing. If we keep them covered, and hearing aid patients will probably tell you this, you have a tendency for moisture buildup, and moisture eventually in the ear can give you problems. There are earplugs that do let in air better than others. Good audiologists around can usually identify those for you and help you identify some that'll let some air in and still help suppress the sound. So it's not total suppression.
How about for just short-term needs, like you're going to a rock concert or you're going to be next to some, you know, enormous fan or, you know, or jet engine or something, you know, something where, you know, for a period of time, fleeting period of time, you think it may be best for you to cover your ears. What kinds of earplugs should you use? When should you use them? When should you not?
Well, that's a great question, because probably most of the damage we see is related to noise. Excessive noise is damaging to inner ears, and it's a very well-established relationship. Almost any earplug will help. So you can go to the pharmacy, the hardware store, and pick up the little foam plugs. They are way better than nothing. They will attenuate sounds often, 20 decibels, give or take a bit. The ear muffs that go over the ear can further attenuate sounds, and sometimes the combination of both is used for people around very loud noise. So I will tell people, when you're going to be in that situation, grab a handful of those little earplugs, because probably the people next to you could use some too, yeah. And just stick them in. They're comfortable, they work, and they will help protect in those isolated situations.
As you point out, they tend to attenuate about 20 decibels, but there's a slight variation, you know, depending on how much money you spend on the different type of earplug. One might say, oh, 21 decibels. Another one might say 18 decibels. What's the difference?
Not enough.
Other than 3 decibels.
Yeah. I wasn't going to go there.
Thank you.
But the difference is really minute. The main thing is that you're protecting, that you're limiting the amount of sound. We generally, as a rough rule of thumb, think that 80 decibels exposure for an 8-hour period is when you start to get damage. And then the louder the sound, the lesser the time you have to be exposed. So that by the time you're up to 100, 120 decibels, you can't tolerate that very long without damage. So 2-3 decibels is actually quite a bit. But in this case, the fact that you're putting something in is way better than nothing. If you're going to be in a noisy situation as a routine, then we would look for a more attenuating plug and do an even better job. But for that incidental situation that you mentioned, I think anything would be great.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing hearing health with otolaryngologist Dr. Michael Novak. He's from Carl's Audiology and Hearing Services, and we welcome your questions and comments for Dr. Novak at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up is Jeff in St. Charles. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, guys. Merry Christmas.
Right back at you.
Hopefully it's not a noisy Christmas. Christmas music, right?
Right.
Actually, you know, it's funny. I have vertigo, and, you know, I think a lot of it came on from me running heavy equipment and power tools and whatnot back, you know, 30, 40 years ago. Now I'm dating myself, but I'm 56. But back in the 70s and early 80s, that whole idea of, you know, running a chainsaw or you know, a saw or anything, riding motorcycles without any kind of earplugs, and nobody forced it. Nobody even tried to recommend it. It's the opposite now, of course. And I always do that, too, because I'm always working with heavy equipment still. But, you know, the one thing I laugh at is I was at a race here this year at the down in Joliet, a stock car race. I saw people walking around with no earplugs in their ears. And I'm, you know, I don't know what they're trying to be, macho or what, but it's deafening down there. Even with earplugs on it, you still, I have headphones that I wear and earplugs. But because of that, I've lost half my hearing in one ear and about a portion in another ear. So I tell people, I don't care who it is, little kids, big kids, no matter how noisy or little noisy it is, wear earplugs. And, yes, I carry about 5 or 6 pairs with me on a daily basis.
I think we're going to make you the poster child for noise protection.
You should.
Yeah, that's a wonderful comment. And I think you hit it exactly when you mentioned that when you're young, you first of all think you're invincible in lots of ways and don't understand that prevention is the only treatment. Once a nerve cell is damaged, it's gone in the ear. And if you've got about 30,000, and as they gradually get knocked off over time, you'll have more and more hearing loss, more and more difficulty understanding. And the only way to continue to do well is to protect and save. And it's a hard message to get across to people who feel like nothing can hurt me, or I can hear fine, don't worry about it. But when you walk out of a situation and your ears are ringing, that typically tells you that you've had at least some temporary noise damage, and possibly some of that will become permanent. So that's a rule that it's way too loud, and you're absolutely correct that when you walk around and you've had damage, you want to tell the world. You want to say, don't do what I did. When you've got young workers around you, you want to be the example, and it sounds like you do a great job. But as for educating the rest of the world, that's difficult to do. Some of the rock musicians now who come out of the 70s, 80s, 90s and have had pretty significant hearing losses are doing a great job of trying to educate young people who may listen to them to turn it down, put on your earplugs, and try to protect what you have.
Jeff noted that he occasionally suffers from vertigo, and I guess vertigo, dizziness, lightheadedness are all things that can have can be impacted in some way by hearing damage or hearing problems. How so? Why?
Well, the inner ear has two compartments, basically. One, the cochlea for hearing, and one, the vestibular system that handles balance, and they're often interrelated. So many times, whatever disease process or problem is affecting the hearing affects balance also. And it's typically, as he described, vertigo, which is the sensation of motion, feeling like you're spinning is the classic, and often with nausea. That's more of an inner ear related vertigo. Otherwise, there are hundreds of causes for dizziness and unsteadiness. But yeah, those two things are often interrelated. You're right.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Novak from Carl's Audiology and Hearing Services about a variety of issues related to hearing and your ears. We welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we will take more of your phone calls and emails after a short break. This is Focus.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear revelations from well-known actors, like Zach Galifianakis on the story behind his last name.
It's actually shortened, Terry. My real last name is Galifianakisberg. That's an exclusive for your show.
Fresh Air, bringing you some of the biggest names in American culture and some of the most difficult to pronounce. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from Wesley United Methodist Church on the corner of Goodwin and Green in Urbana, serving the campus and community this season. The Wesley Special Family Christmas Eve service is at 4 p.m., or a traditional Christmas Eve service with carols and communion is at 7. Details at wesleyui.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Dr. Michael Novak from Carl's Audiology and Hearing Services is here with us today to field your questions about hearing health at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or as always, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And next up is Marlene in Urbana. Marlene, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for the program,
sure.
As all of your programs. I have a question that really is regarding airplane flight. As my husband and I both have gotten older, we've had different ear problems, recurring ear infections. We both have sinus problems. And when we go on the airplane, we're terribly uncomfortable. Now, we both have, I realize, you know, things that set us up for that. My husband even gets the dizziness, and he's fainted, and they thought he had a heart attack and abort an airplane flight one time for him, and we've decided probably his ears. But what I was wondering is if you have been noticing an increase in problems with a lot of people due to the airlines economizing on their pressurization system.
I can't say that I have. People tend to do better than others with the ability to fly, and it does sometimes change with time. But, you know, when you think about how we were designed a few hundred thousand years ago, we were never meant to be up off the ground or really underwater very far. So eustachian tubes are meant to adjust for pressure differences, but not at the magnitude that we subject ourselves to. So many people just cannot fly comfortably. And then if you add any chronic nasal congestion, allergies, sinus problems, upper respiratory infections. It just magnifies things. And some people are very, very uncomfortable to the point where they don't fly. If we get people at that level, sometimes we'll put the little pressure equalizing tubes in like we use in children, and they can fly very comfortably. And I have people who are in business and have to fly, but can't do it without some kind of pressure release.
What if they wear earplugs before they take off all the way through the flight until after they land? Is that good or bad?
There's a commercial little plug available, and it, quite frankly, doesn't make a lot of sense physiologically. However, I've got people who come in and say, if I put them in, I can fly better, and if I don't, I don't do well. And, you know, it's cheap, it's easy, it's not harmful, and if it works for you, you know, by all means, use them. But it really, when you take it apart, it doesn't make much sense. Yeah. Decongestants sometimes help if you're able to take your over-the-counter cold medicines. Can be sometimes helpful in relieving nasal congestion, making your ears pop. Where you hold your nose, blow gently to make them pop, can be very helpful if you do that on the way down. Mm. People should not have trouble as the plane is going up.
Right.
But as you descend, that's when the eustachian tube function is critical. And sometimes every 30 seconds, making them pop when they start to feel full will keep you out of trouble. Because once you get a certain amount of pressure differential in the eardrum versus outside, you just can't overcome it. And then it's just painful. And then you just have to kind of tough it out.
The ear device that you're speaking of, is that something we would come to the audiology center for?
No, actually, there you can see them in most pharmacies, most airports.
I don't mean the one that you were speaking of that seems to work but doesn't make sense. I mean the other one you spoke of.
Oh, when we put a ventilating...
Pressurization.
Yeah, the ventilating tube actually has to make... we have to make a little hole in your eardrum and stick a small tube in there. And that's something that any otolaryngologist can do in the office.
I see. Okay. But you haven't noticed more people having trouble as they pressurize, you know, less efficiently on airplanes? No.
I think the people who do have trouble will have more trouble.
Okay.
But I haven't really seen empirically an increase in the number of people having trouble.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. I remember... this would have been 20, 25 years ago on a flight when I was not feeling well and was dealing with what turned out to be a pretty massive sort of earache over the course of the flight. Was that an ear infection most likely? Is it when you're sick, when you have an ear infection, should you just not fly at all no matter what?
Probably not an ear infection. That would usually take you 2 or 3 days to get bacteria and get the infection going.
Yeah.
But the ability to... feel pain is basically based on stretching an eardrum. It's like some other body surfaces. Stretching hurts, whether you stretch it in where there's not enough pressure under the drum or stretch it out with too much pressure, that's where you get the pain. And then often very quickly fluid builds up. You'll break a few blood vessels underneath the eardrum, for instance, and get some fluid. So probably not ear infection, but a rapid buildup of fluid or negative pressure that's very painful.
Is that what earaches are, essentially?
Yes. That's what the great majority of people, when they have an earache, it's an eardrum that's stretching rather acutely. Like most tissues, the eardrum will accommodate very slow changes and become quite distorted painlessly in many situations. But that rapid change, like you did over a few minutes, is often very painful. And then it can take you several days to finally get it to clear, if not weeks.
Let's go next to Lawrence in Savoy. Hi, Lawrence.
Oh, good morning. I have a question about audiometry and the hearing aids and hearing loss. If on audiometry the graph shows there's some hearing loss, but still working, but decreased hearing acuity, perceptivity, etc., what is there in our science that says it is highly advisable, sort of a modification of the use it or lose it rule, as it were, that you should have a hearing aid to prevent further loss on those particular portions of the audiometry graph?
Most people, when they talk about hearing loss, I think as you're referring, it's typically centered over the high frequencies, the middle and high frequencies, and usually the low frequencies are pretty good. It's very characteristic of a lot of nerve damage. And the hearing aid doesn't necessarily, it's not like a muscle for the most part that allows you to continue to use it and so you don't lose it. Most of the losses are determined by environmental factors or inherited factors that you can't really change and prevent. The hearing aid is meant to help you function better in your average daily situation. So there's nothing really where you have to use one to prevent further decrease. You use them so that you can stay in conversations better and function in your average daily life.
While we're on the subject of hearing aids and equipment, we have an email from Dennis who asks if you could discuss your experience with the cochlear implant and the life expectancy of that equipment.
Cochlear implants are a whole different level. And yes, my practice started here in 1984 with cochlear implants when they're barely at their infancy. A cochlear implant differs dramatically from a hearing aid. A hearing aid simply makes acoustic sounds louder and more accessible. It does some filtering and processing. When patients get to a point that they have a severe to profound loss and cannot benefit from a hearing aid, meaning even with their best hearing aids, they have to lip read, they can't use a telephone well, they don't stay in conversations well, then we go to the next level of treatment with cochlear implants, which is a device where I actually surgically implant electrodes into the inner ear. So I will run some tiny electrodes into the inner ear, and we electrically stimulate the hearing nerve. So they have benefited and improved tremendously over the 27, 28 years that I've been working with them. As you can imagine, they have been an offshoot of the microelectronics, and you think of cell phone changes over 25 years and computer changes, et cetera, et cetera. So they're meant for a subgroup of severe to profound losses who do not benefit well from a standard hearing aid. They can be tremendously beneficial, life-changing.
What does it sound like for someone who has a cochlear implant? Are they hearing the world the way that those of us that don't have maybe those kinds of hearing problems hear the world? Or does it sound a little different?
It sounds different because obviously even our best devices processing at 30, 50, 100,000 pulses per second are nowhere near as good as a normal ear. But they'll give you a full frequency response. They will allow you to hear sounds you couldn't hear at relatively normal levels. Most adults who have had hearing and lost it can easily carry on a conversation. Many can use the telephone again. So there's enough information that you can comfortably carry on relatively normally. For children, and we will put implants into infants because early intervention is critical for best long-term results, they often will develop their hearing around what we're delivering. So their central hearing systems and nerves and brain will accommodate the sound that's being delivered. It becomes their normal. Many, many of these children, most actually, will develop relatively normal speech, normal hearing capability, even though it may not sound anything like normal hearing.
It's my understanding that within the deaf community and within those that have hearing impairments, that there's maybe some still some debate, some even controversy about cochlear implants. I wonder if that's still the case today. It certainly was, I guess, when they first came along, and what your reaction is to that.
Initially, there was a fairly adamant reaction by and polarization of both sides on delivery of hearing, use of hearing and speech versus the traditional use of sign language as a basis for communication. It's become less and less of an issue over time. It still is present. And fortunately, the technology has improved tremendously. Early identification for children, we now should identify almost every hearing loss at birth or within the first couple of years after birth so we can intervene effectively. Our process now and always has been to give people a choice, make people aware of their options, give them the ability to make an informed decision of what works best for them or their child for a lifetime. Understand the pros and cons and then make an informed decision. We support whatever that person's decision is. If a parent chooses to sign and raise their children that way, we support that. Just do it well. And if you choose to use your hearing and speech, that's fine. We can do that for you. But informed decisions are where we go. And fortunately, many people go now to really allow people to have that decision.
And how long do these implants last? Does it work for a lifetime? Do we know?
They are designed to last 50 to 70 years. So my probably longest using patient is 26, 27 years, still functioning very effectively, the implant working well. It's like any microelectronics. They will occasionally fail, probably 1%, where we can take one out and put in a new one. We don't do any automatic upgrades just because of technology changes. However, most of the changes are made on the external processing side where it doesn't require more surgery. But yeah, they're meant to last a long, long time.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there is still time for your questions and comments about hearing health for Dr. Michael Novak at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have an email from Nancy who says, my ears feel plugged up from August until hard frosts if we get them. Sometimes it's so painful I have to wear my eyeglass arms over rather than behind the ears. Any suggestions, anything to do?
That type of problem tends to often be related to allergies, and especially in this area where we have the agricultural base and we have fields that are turned up and we've got dust and we have pollens of every sort going around. Often they're allergic based to where the eustachian tube again doesn't work well, and they tend to have that discomfort. For an external ear to be sensitive is sometimes related more to factors such as just wind. Some people just very sensitive to cold air hitting the eardrum. But from her description, where it comes from a hard frost, it's typically your hay fever people. And allergy treatments can be very effective.
Something I wanted to make sure that we talked about today, and it's a subject close to my heart because I wear them all the time. I'm wearing headphones right now. So are you. There are a lot of people that walk around wearing earbuds all the time now, wherever they go. Do you have any sense of whether those earbuds are better or worse for you than headphones with, you know, sort of big floppy pads? What should we listen to music on, or whatever it is we use, those things we attach to our MP3 players and smartphones, whatever it is we listen to? What should we use?
The answer to that is basically whatever's comfortable for you, for a style. However, the concerns we have are noise. And whether you call it music or it's industrial noise, as far as your ear is concerned, it's a volume relationship. It's the loudness that gets you into trouble. So you can deliver a very high volume with an in-the-ear type of speaker or an earbud. You don't have as much kind of leaking out and not going straight to the eardrum, straight on into the hearing nerve. So you're capable of delivering a pretty high volume with the earbud and the other types. But basically, if you keep it at a reasonable volume, 70, 80 decibels, which is a little louder than an average conversation, you should be fine with any of the styles.
Okay. Let's take another call. We have, looks like, Ann on the line from Champaign. Ann, good morning.
Good morning. I had heard that mothers who nurse their babies had less hearing ear problems, and it certainly worked with mine. And I have two children, never had any ear problems, and I never did either. And I wondered if there was any truth to that.
I think that some of the studies that we have seen that are well done probably do lend truth to that. The reason many children get into trouble is eustachian tube shape and function, which is often genetically predetermined. However, the ability to fend off or ward off certain bacteria and that kind of, or viruses, that you can get that protection from the breastfeeding can be very beneficial. So, yeah, I think there is some truth to that.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks for the call. Dan is in Ivesdale. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. I had a question for you. I don't know if this is in your realm of expertise or not, but I, throughout my career and stuff, being around loud noise, I religiously wore earplugs, and I would swap between plastic and foam and sometimes just using cotton at times. And I've developed a like a real chronic itch in my ear canal, I guess, for lack of a better term. I don't know if that's something that would be for a dermatologist to look at. It's not really inflamed. It's just a crazy itch that's always there. And I've tried quite a few different things, and I just can't seem to get it to go away. And if you have any suggestions, I'll just listen to you off the air. And if not, I'll just go battle it on my own.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
No, that's actually a very common complaint that people have, probably not related to earplugs, but it just kind of happens. Sometimes it's dry skin that develops over time, the lack of moisture or earwax rumen that makes you more prone to itching. It can be very difficult to get rid of, but we first things we try is often just kind of home remedies, a little hydrogen peroxide to clean out the ear, make sure you don't have wax. Some people use a vinegar alcohol solution like the swimmer's ear type of things, but much beyond that, we use cortisone type of eardrops or ointments that can be useful. But it is something that can be addressed often fairly successfully and can be just a real aggravation. You're correct.
You mentioned earwax, and I feel like the best public service maybe we could provide for the entire hour is maybe to talk just very briefly about an appropriate way to deal with any excess earwax and what's inappropriate to deal with it.
We're not big on Q-tips, even though they're very, very commonly used. And the biggest reason is sometimes it packs wax down in. Sometimes you will bump your arm and get damage to an ear canal or eardrum. So we avoid, but I know they're commonly used, and if used safely, probably not a problem. Most of what we recommend are getting a wax softener. There are little ear wash kits that you can get where you put a wax softener for a few days and then rinse it out. We use a little syringe that half water, half hydrogen peroxide, and just flush it out. Seems to be a very safe way to approach it.
And there's some over-the-counter, use ear drops. The Debrox is one that occurs
correct
to me. That, and is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's the same
kind of
thing.
Put a few drops in and then just and flush it out
carefully. Absolutely. And then we find that to be the most effective for most people.
I think we have time for one more call. Listener from Champaign. Go ahead. Good morning.
Hi. I'm calling about Meniere's disease. Have you discussed that already?
No.
And there's a concern that I might have it. And so I'm an older person, and I was reading that it usually comes for people younger. But is there something that, would they do those implants if you had something like that, or what would they do for it?
That's a very specific inner ear problem that has a characteristic pattern and history and usually pretty characteristic hearing test identification. It's something that in this case probably is best that you see a good audiologist, an otolaryngologist. That's a very specific problem. If the hearing loss gets bad enough in both ears, cochlear implants are effective, but you're way into treatment before we would get a diagnosis, and that's a very specific issue that I probably should be followed up by somebody.
Well, I am going to the doctor, but I noticed you were talking about ears today, so
yeah.
This is a new thing for me, and you know, to be experiencing this, and so I just thought I'd call.
No.
All right, thanks.
Good luck.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. What fascinates you most about the ear?
Oh,
there has to be something.
It's incredibly complex, and the fact that we can sit here and have a conversation and these noises fluctuating all over the place and we can understand each other is incredible. It's tremendously sensitive, flexible, versatile, and we have not a great understanding of how it works. And then you hook it to a brain, and it's just this kind of mysterious thing that we need to work with and understand. So what fascinates me, I guess, is the fact that we can do it at all, and then how can we try to reproduce it? How can we make it better? How can we help people who don't have that ability?
It's kind of amazing to me when you think in those terms, because usually the noises emanating from me don't make a lick of sense. So I'm pleased to hear somebody thinks they make sense. How does one become an otolaryngologist?
Otolaryngology is a surgical subspecialty that requires, after medical school, usually a 6-year process of surgical and medical training in all of the aspects of head and neck surgery. So it's a specialty residency as a surgical subspecialty. And then there are a variety of subspecialties like mine, which often takes an extra year or two of training. cosmetics, head and neck cancer, allergy, pediatrics, laryngology, rhino, on and on and on. So it's a very complicated field.
Do you have to ever have to consult like a lobe man? Is there somebody out there that's just for the earlobe, or, is that maybe a little too specific?
No, actually, you're a little facetious, but earlobes are extremely difficult to create. It takes a very good cosmetic or plastic surgeon to try to create a good earlobe. They're really hard.
All right, that's a subject for another day that we should delve into. Michael Novak is an otolaryngologist with Carl's Audiology and Hearing Services. Dr. Novak, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And we welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, we will welcome your year-end tax questions for a couple of certified public accountants. Then next week, we have some special programs for you. On Monday, Focus will give way at 10 a.m. for a program called the Great American Songbook Holiday Special 2012. Our normal 8 o'clock repeat broadcast will also be preempted with a special entitled Tinsel Tales, NPR Christmas Favorites. On Christmas Day, Tuesday at 10 a.m., we'll present Roll Credits, a Hollywood Holiday. Then at 8 p.m., we'll hear a Radiolab special examining time. Then it is back to the regular schedule. We'll have some encore broadcasts of Focus interviews for you Wednesday through Friday of next week, examining issues ranging from immigration to the life of Julia Child and the writings of J.R.R. Tolkien. That's all next week. Today's show is produced by Travis Stansel. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen.